Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour audio biography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Father Brendan Ford is a Franciscan priest from Ireland who travels the world preaching peace and serving the most vulnerable members of society. Father Ford helped the homeless in Chile during the violent regime of General Augustus Pinochet. He aided victims caught in the crossfire of the Colombia drug war and administered to the poor in war-torn El Salvador and Guatemala. Father Ford has been featured in two documentaries, Friar in Blue Jeans and The Walking Priest. With a population of nearly 40 million people of Irish descent, Father Ford has come to America to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the 1960 Easter Uprising in Dublin by Irish Republicans who took over the General Post Office in an attempt to free themselves from British rule. Father Ford, you've seen some of the worst conditions of poverty imaginable. What do you accomplish in these countries?
I've never felt that I accomplished very much. I accompanied the people, and in the times, there were very difficult times because I arrived in Chile in January of 72 in the government of Salvador Allende, the first socialist Marxist government elected in the world. And then it was overthrown. And it was just that Chile went very quiet. And the fear that came into Chilean people, who were always very joyful and involved in politics itself, the young people. So it was an accompany of those. People couldn't meet in groups or anything. A lot of them came to the church and we worked together and we grew there. So the church also became a certain kind of centre for another way against the regime. And I just felt more than anything I accompanied the people. I was with them in a bit in the struggles, but they did the struggles. So that was in Chile. And then I went to Salvador. I was expelled from Chile.
You were expelled from Chile because?
Because myself and two other priests, we were accused of inciting the young people to politics or to insurrection, which was really stupid. What happened was one of the young boys, well, the young man, he was about 20 years of age, he disappeared. And this was happening in Chile and people disappeared. So what we had was a silent march from one church to another. And in the other church, we celebrated Mass. And then we were accused of inciting the people. Now, they said at that time, we were taken up to the Ministry of the Interior and they had our whole list of what we had done in the last 10 years. They say you're in this place and that place. And they said, well, for respect for the priest, we're going to give you a 30-day or 2 weeks, they said, to get yourself ready, but we're throwing out of Chile. But at that time, the people were just fed up and they wanted somebody to protest, so they supported us. So eventually they didn't give us the 2 weeks. They threw us out. We're taken out of a house and driven to the airport and put in a plane. We had only the clothes we had on us. I remember jeans and sandals and a shirt. And we were taken onto the plane and we were sent off to Argentina. It was a military government there too. So that was all of a sudden. That was Chile. The Chilean people, I have great love for them still. There's just one thing that I loved about them. I love football. And there was a man there who...
Football, you mean their football, soccer, like soccer.
Yeah, soccer. It's the big passion in Latin America. And there was a man there, he had lost his job. He was in a factory. And he got some money when he lost his job. He had an accident. And he bought a television, a colour television, in 1982. And he said to me, look, he says, when you can, come along here, we'll watch the matches together, he said. So I said, fine. Now, there were all mud roads there. There was no pavements or anything. And one day he saw me at shoes. He says, have you no boots, he said. I said, no. And he told one of the daughters, go up there and get those boots, he said, that I have. And he said, these are factory boots. They're no good to me now, he said. You can have these, try them on. And they fit me, so I was delighted. But then I was thrown out of Chile. And I couldn't go back until 7 years later when Pinochet was thrown out of power. And I was saying Mass one day and these two young women came along and they said to me, do you remember our father? I said, of course I do. I said, how is he? He said, oh, he died. He said, 3 years ago. But he said, Before he died, he sent us out. He said, go out and buy a pair of boots, he said. And he gave them the measurement. And when we came back, we didn't know what he wanted. But when we came back with the boots, he says, now give those to Father Brendan whenever he comes back, he said. So they gave me the pair of boots that the father had left for me. So
love in a strange way.
Love in a strange way. But it's just kind of the... just the warmth of the people. It's kind of, if you're company, we accompanied one another, a kind of a very warmth grows up. Yeah.
And then there was Colombia. They weren't very kind there.
No, I went to Salvador first after that. And again, the war was on in Salvador. Now, we talk about the Eastern commemoration. I remember one day, it was 1988, and had a certain context with football too, because Ireland were playing England in the European Cup, the first time we ever qualified for a major tournament. And I just heard the news on the BBC, Ireland beat England 1-0. And I came out and I met one of the commandanti of the guerrilla. And he said to me, he said, you're very happy, Father, what's up? I said, Ireland have beaten England in the European Cup. And we got talking, but then he said to me, he says, we're going to negotiate a peace, he said. We're not like the Irish, we're not going to fight for 800 years, he said. So the Salvadorian people in the village where I was, one woman had 9 children, 8 were killed. 8 were killed, and her husband. I asked her one time, Senora Francisca, what do you want? I just want my last girl, that she'll be alive. And another one, Lola, 6 children, they were all killed.
And another killed one, by?
Killed in the war, killed by the army, basically. They were killed by the army.
Well, you had your own difficulties, didn't they? Colombia wanted you out. Didn't they send you a message through a woman coming to your door?
No. Well, I never felt that. I went to Colombia just for 6 months. I was asked to accompany again a peasant community that were being attacked. They declared themselves a peace community and they didn't want any armed group entering. So I was asked. But then one day an armed group came in and they killed 6 people. They asked, how many people here, men, are there between 25 and 40 years of age? It was only a small village. There was only about 30 families there. And it was 6 men and they shot them. And they said, if you don't leave the rest, if you don't get out of here, we're going to come back and we're going to kill more.
Well, didn't they send, I read somewhere, that the Colombian army sent the woman who was decapitated to your door?
Not me. After that particular, where the 6 people were killed, the people decided to stay on and they asked me, I was supposed to go up to Costa Rica, and they asked me, what are you going to do, Father? So I they were expecting me in 2 weeks up in Costa Rica, my bottom at the provincial. And to tell you, I hadn't the guts to say I was going, to look at them and say I'm going. I hadn't the guts. So I said, OK, I'd stay as well. But what happened after that was we found a body then. He had his, just outside the door, with his necks cut, you know, sliced. Yeah. But I was never told directly to get out or anything in Colombia.
That was a hint, though.
It was a hint, yeah. You get hints, yeah. But you learn to live, you learn to work and to live and to survive, which is terribly important. You know, you do that.
Well, your sister was kind of, your late sister, was Barbara, was worried. She kept going from one place to another trying to get you out of there. You can laugh now, but I don't think it was funny to her or any other member of your family.
No, it probably wasn't funny for them. But an interesting thing in this, my father, he was in the Easter Rising. One of his great heroes was Paul Robeson. Now, there's a thing that I can't understand here in the States. You know, I love coming and visit. Paul Robeson has been written out of history, not only out of the history of the United States. He's been written out of black history. You never hear him mentioned.
Oh, no. I teach at Rutgers University in Newark, and he's celebrated there.
But it's very small. If you get it, people now, I know, for example, sisters, nuns, who were very committed in Colombia and from the United States, they'd never heard of him. You will never hear him playing a song, Paul Robeson, on the radio or anything.
Oh, he could play, and he was also a good football player.
Pardon?
He was also a very good
football player. He was a great all-rounder. He was a great, yeah. He's one of the great, I think for me, I got it from my father, but for me, he was one of the great heroes as well.
You're listening to Conversations with Alan Walper on WBGO 88.3 and WBGO.org. Our guest, as you've been hearing with his lovely accent, lovely Irish accent, is Father Brendan Ford, a Franciscan priest from Ireland who has served some of the most needy and vulnerable people in South America. Why South America? You spent most of your time there, it seems.
I did. I spent the last 42 years. Nearly all my years as a priest I've spent in South America. I went there the first time in 1969. I wanted, even as a young lad, when I wanted to be a priest, I remember saying to the Franciscan, I said, well, I want to go to South America. And there was no Irish Franciscans there at that time. And he said, by the time you're ordained, there will be. So as it was, there is. So that's why I went to Chile and El Salvador as well. So I always had kind of a romantic vision. I don't know where it came from, maybe from the movies or something, but I always wanted to go to Latin America.
Did you always want to be a priest? You know, it's kind of a controversial in some families. They just don't want to want their sons and daughters to be priests and nuns. Did you have any problem with your?
No. I never had any problems with my parents. And even taking into that, for example, in the Civil War in Ireland after the insurrection had happened, when my father was excommunicated along with other men, you know.
Your father was excommunicated because he was part of that group that attacked the post office in Dublin?
No, not for that, for a different reason.
For
the Civil War afterwards, when it was divided. Okay. And he took the anti-treaty side. And they were in jail and they went on hunger strike. And they were on hunger strike for 40 days.
And when was that?
That was in 1922. Yeah. And so they were then, but he was always a Catholic. They all did, but they had the force of their beliefs to do what they believed. So I had no problem with my father and my mother when I decided to become a priest. I had good support, yeah. So.
Did your father tell you the story about that invasion 100 years ago? 450 people died, 1,200 were injured.
He talked very little about it. He talked a little about it. I think like most people in the wars, they didn't want to talk about it after. He did now and again, and he would get emotional. He remembered some of the people that were there that he would talk about. And he was in the first group that went to take what's called the magazine fort, where the British held some armaments. There was very few. So he was in that. And there was a young boy shot in that. And I know that upset him very much, that he felt. I don't think they were really prepared for what happened, in the sense of war is never pretty, you know, no matter what type it is. And a lot of the leaders were poets and dreamers, a bit like that.
I was really surprised there were so many poets in
there. So they're not really in
They
a
weren't really
prepared.
Army. They were sort of really the old-fashioned guys off the street without uniforms, right?
That's right.
Actually,
yeah.
You don't wear a uniform. You don't even wear a collar. people can't see that.
Yeah, which they... Well, I prefer to be this way. That's people ask you sometimes. Well, I just prefer, but I don't mind if other fellas want to. It's I don't think it's very important the type of clothes we wear. You know, but I think at that, yeah, they were kind of dreamers. But it was the first spark of the insurrection that afterwards came.
You said they were dreamers. Then your father was a dreamer, and he made you a dreamer.
I probably would be. I would have a dream that a different world is possible. And as a Christian, for example, for me, as a Christian, the motivation is that I think that Jesus had that dream, what he called the kingdom of God, but a different way of life that people can live. Now, a thing that shocks me here in the States, in this moment of the politics, I love coming to the States and my cousins are here, but the thing really that shocks me now, when they talk about we're going to build a wall down in the south on the border. Now, I find that horrifying. And a lot of Christians are backing that. They're backing that. A lot of the evangelicals are backing that. Now, I feel a thing. You build a wall there.
You're talking actually about Donald Trump.
Trump, yeah.
He wants to build a wall, he said, because he wants to keep the Mexicans from coming here.
Yeah. Now, if you build that wall,
yeah,
the Christians, Jesus isn't going to be on the inside of the wall. He's not going to be this side. Jesus is going to end up, he'll be on the other side. Because everything he always did was identifying, if you did it to one of the little ones, you did it to me. And so I think for Christians, they should think about this an awful lot. You can end up with a Christianity religion, but without Jesus, without Christ. And I think it's terribly dangerous, just the mentality. And there's something terrible about building a wall.
The Pope was very explicit about that. And there was, of course, a controversy. Every time a religious leader says anything to do with politics, there's chaos. Should religious leaders, priests, actually popes, should they become involved in that kind of debate?
If there is injustice happening, yeah, they should preach. Anybody should preach, and you have the right. What's the point of talking about, say, you're a follower of Jesus and you're not talking injustice? It's not that you're talking about necessarily political parties. You're not into that. Whoever does it, you have to speak against justice. Oscar Romero was the great example of that, Bishop Oscar Romero in El Salvador. He wasn't aligned to any political party, but he denounced, after they blew up all the radio stations, you couldn't talk. When he celebrated Mass on a Sunday, he gave half an hour telling them everything that had happened, the crimes that had happened and doing it. And they killed him because he was outspoken. He wasn't a violent man. He wasn't a political man. He's quite conservative in a lot of ways. But he felt people have to know the truth, and that's terribly important.
Did you speak out in all these countries that you went to?
Did I speak out?
Or were you just a troublemaker walking around and telling people how to behave?
No, one thing, I wasn't a troublemaker telling people how to behave because I don't believe in that. I don't think I have the right.
Okay, then what did you do?
I accompanied the people, and any of the decisions that they made were decisions, for example, in Colombia, when they were killing in the village and the people decided to stay, they asked me, what'll you do? So I said, if ye decide to stay, I'll stay. If they decide to go, I'll go. But I didn't make decisions. I learned that. And I learned also, it's not my role to tell people what to do. And I learned an awful lot from that then, because for listening is terribly important. One of the problems, if we go in, if you're powerful, you feel you have the right to go in and tell people what to do. One of the good things about going to a country, you don't know the language. And if you don't know the language, you have to listen. You have to learn. And that helps you an awful lot to people. But I always felt that the main thing is to listen to the people. And then we can do, because we have an education, we can help as well. We can put in our bit as well. But no, I say that not in any big way. But I haven't for years and years ever told anybody what to do.
Have you ever heard from the Vatican or anywhere else telling you what to say or how to behave?
No, I never heard that, no.
Okay. That's the voice of Father Brendan Ford, an Irish Franciscan priest whose work in South and Central America has been the subject of two documentaries and celebrated, and I can vouch for this because I've been reading them, in numerous articles around the world. I'm just curious, when people talk to you, they don't see you as a priest because you don't have a collar.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they talk to you more freely because of that? Is that possible?
I don't even think that way. I know the places that I work, the people know I'm a priest, and they will talk, you know, when I'm with them. They do, and we talk. I went back to El Salvador now. I visited after 30 years, and I didn't have to. They gave me food in every place. I didn't have to. And the poor people, the peasants in the countryside, a place to stay. And so the clothes aren't really that important, I think. No,
they're not?
No, they're not, no.
You sure?
Yeah.
Do you think more people would talk to priests and rabbis and imams and all kinds of people if they didn't wear all kinds of outfits that identify them?
People
what do
you might
think?
People are different. Some people would like you to be dressed up. Some people like clothes. Others don't. But in the end, it's how you live and how you share with the people, whatever clothes you're wearing. I mean, I don't ever think about what I'm going to wear now, really. I would. For it's a funeral or something, I would obviously put on vestments, or when I'm saying Mass, you know, when you're saying Mass. But for every day, no, because your clothes aren't important.
Do you ever think of running for office?
No, I don't think priests should run for office because you lose a lot of freedom.
Oh, in America they'd have.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that. I think we should be outside it, and I think we should be... I'm not saying prophets we should be. We're always looking, we talk, we want priests and we want this, but we need people with voice for justice, you know. I would hope so here in the States as well. Now, there would be some candidate that would... Who's exciting the young people in this election?
Who?
it's Sanders, the young people, in the election.
Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, because he's talking a different talk.
What do you mean?
He's talking about for health for all the people, for housing. He's talking the things that get to the people. Whether he'd win it or not, probably not, because the people would be afraid of that. But it's a different language. Hopefully somebody will come up with speak a different language.
Do you think perhaps that the media, the people, my colleagues, play a role that's a little bit too much into politics, that they become more important than the people that they cover? It's one of the things we talk about.
I do a bit like that. I see, especially on television sometimes, they're advertising this person has been here, there and every place, listen here, because she or he is going to be in this area. And then you're wondering, is this the point that you're listening to this presenter, you know, and not so much the message that they're going to give? I think there is a bit too much of that, but I certainly respect the media and the terribly important role that they have to play, because an awful lot of stuff wouldn't come out if the media weren't there. And very lot of courageous people as well in the media. A lot of martyrs in the media as well.
Well, you're only 72 years old, which means you only got about 25 years left.
Thank you.
What do you see in front of you? What's your future all about? Where is Father Brendan Ford going to go next? You just came back from Honduras, right?
Well, I was only passing through Honduras, really.
You're only passing through?
Yeah, I was there for 4 weeks. I was just passing through. The exact area, I don't know what it's going to be. But I'd always had this kind of rules for myself. I will only go to a place where there's a need and where the people say, are poor, there's a need there. And I'll only go if they want me to be there.
Have you heard from anyone who wanted you back?
Well, the people in El Salvador would love to go back. And also, I worked with indigenous people, the most lovely people in the world in Honduras, the Koji people, if you ever want to look them up. And they've a peaceful, for them, God is the mother. They've kept their own traditions, their religion and everything. And they taught me how to listen. If they want to do what God wants them to do, they listen to the mountain, they go to the mountain, listen to the mother because she's there. And they taught me, you have to listen. I remember what an indigenous man said to me in Guatemala as well. They were praying for baptism one day in the mountains where they escaped from all the violence. And suddenly the helicopters were coming. When the helicopters come, they started their shooting to try and clear out the place. And I said, what happened? He says, we were all scared. We start running. And then I said, what happened? Well, the clouds came down, he said. The helicopters had to go back. They couldn't come. And then he said to me, do you know something, Father? He said, God is stronger than the helicopters. So I always keep that in my mind, too.
I always wonder about, you're in a country that is still trying to find itself.
Sure.
There's Northern Ireland and there's Southern Ireland, which is... how do you deal with that? That's talk about politics.
Yeah.
Will it ever be resolved?
It probably will in the long run. At least they are working together now, which was kind of impossible to think about.
100 years ago.
Or even 30 years ago, to think that you would have a loyalist and a Republican forming the government.
In the same room.
In the same room. They mightn't like to be in the same room, but they're in the same room, which is terribly important. And that's a huge step in Irish politics. And they're working more between the two governments in the northern state and in the republic. So they're working much closer together. Now, their steps, in the long run, we're here very shortly. In the whole, since the world was formed or since the universe was formed, we came very lately, human beings. We came in the last minute, if you take it in a day. So, I mean, there's plenty of time yet to resolve it.
How do you identify yourself?
Pardon?
How do you identify yourself? Which part of Ireland are you from? Do people ask you that?
I always say, no, I'm from Ireland. People ask me, they say, where are you from? And I say, I'm from Ireland. And then they say, from the north or from the south? No, I'm from Ireland, I say. And they ask, well, what's this, the north, the south? I said, well, in every country there's a north and a south and east and the west, I said. I'm from Ireland, but I say there's two states. There's one Ireland, there's two states. There's the Northern Ireland state and there's the Republic of Ireland state. But there's one Ireland. I identify myself that way. Yeah.
And people ask?
People ask every place. I was in the jungle in a community of lepers. And it was before Mass and one man came to make his confession. And after the confession, he asked me, where are you from, Father? And he had no eyes. The leprosy had eaten his eyes, young boy. He had no hands. And he said to me, where are you from, Father? I said, from Ireland. And he said, from the north or from the south? And I'm in the middle of the jungle in the Amazon River. And he says, and then he says to me, do you know something, Father? I pray for peace in your country every day. A leper. And that moved me so much that the tears started. I couldn't believe it. This was in the time of the violence in the north of Ireland. And here was a leper who was no eyes, he had no hands, praying for my people every day. And anyway, the tears started coming. And he sensed there was something up. He didn't say anything to me. But just with the bit of arm that he had left, he searched out my arm and he started caressing it. He started caressing my arm, he said. So that's how he ended up. The leper was the priest. And I was the person that needed some healing, came from a violent country. And there was a leper there who had this gentleness and the tenderness to take of our people and also to heal me as well. So you learn from people. I found at every part, I've learned so much from the people. So people, sometimes people say, it's a great life. I said, I have a great life. But I put my own bit into it too, you know.
No regrets.
No, I have no regrets. No point in it.
I was thinking that, and this is sort of going back again, and this is very sensitive, when your sister, who you love so much and who loved you absolutely, and actually I think went to President Clinton to try to find you in Colombia at one point, she died after she went to a hospital. And that I read, there's a lot of stories about her.
Yeah.
And I know you miss her very much. And that's because the hospital, I guess the Beaumont Hospital, did not do what they were supposed to do.
She had an operation, I can't remember, stomach operation, right? It was a success. What happened afterward, she got a hospital bug, what's called the MRSA. I don't know if they call it the same here in the States.
MRSA.
Yeah, and she got that. The operation was a success. But she was put into a room, and this happened to a lot of other people too, where she picked up the bug in the hospital, and that's what killed her. And that was the height of what we call the Celtic Tiger. Then there was money flowing. They were actually saying Ireland is the second most richest country in the world. And how could it be that you couldn't have spare rooms for people who were so sick that you put them into wards where they picked up bugs? She died of that. You asked me, do I regret anything? I do regret one or two things. But what I do regret is the times I have hurt people at times, and I regret that very much.
How did you hurt them?
Just by being very insensitive at times. And sometimes I didn't realise maybe how much people might have loved or liked me, and I wasn't sensitive to it. And at times, perhaps, I made decisions, especially earlier on, without taking people into account. So I know I hurt people. I do kind of regret that, but I don't regret my life, no.
No, you sound like there's a lot more. And I want to say, as I mentioned before, you're only 72 years old, so I assume you'll be continuing your good works in years to come, Father Brendan Ford.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your incredible personal and professional life with us. Joanna Wolpe is the senior producer of our program, and Doug Doyle is the executive producer. Conrad Saguinetti is our engineer. Should you like to listen to any of our other autobiographies, all you have to do is Google Conversations with Alan Wolper. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Until we talk again, I'm Alan Wolper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.